Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. I have a great show today. In the studio with me is the excellent, the wonderful, and the amazing journalist, Tom Philpott, who joined me last week, as those of you would remember, to talk about GM crops. Today, we're going to be joined on the phone by Dr. Charles Benbrook, who has published about 2 years ago, I think, published a sort of seminal study of following 15 years worth of genetically modified organisms and came up with some conclusions that were, shall we say, problematic, to say the least, for the likes of Monsanto, Syngenta, DuPont, and Dow. I'm going to give a quick bio of my guests before we jump in. Just for those of you who don't remember, for 5 years, Tom Philpott has served as a columnist, food editor, and senior food writer for the online environmental site Grist. He's now at Mother Jones, and he is a co-founder of Maverick Farms, a center for sustainable food education in Valley Crucis, North Carolina. I said that correctly, didn't
That's
I?
That's right.
Okay, very good. You used to write on the stock market, I thought was very interesting, and I want to talk about that sometime again with you about sort of commodity trading.
Sure.
Anyway, and Dr. Benbrook, otherwise known as Chuck, is a research professor at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. He is the program leader of Measure to Manage Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health. His career has focused on developing science-based systems for evaluating the public health, environmental, and economic impacts of changes in agricultural systems, biotech, and policy. He has worked extensively on pesticide use and risk assessment and the development of biointensive integrated pest management. He played an important role in the evolution of the 1996 Food Quality Protection Act and has produced multiple reports on agricultural biotechnology. Welcome back to the program, Chuck. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I'm really excited about having you two wonks wonk out for the benefit of a junior wonk like me. Chuck, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Very good, sir. So, gentlemen, let us start with a little discussion of Chuck's 2012 study that I referenced earlier in my intro that was not particularly favorable to GMO tech. Can you give us a sense of what that study, how it was set up, and what you concluded?
Sure. I was aware, as most of us, following the introduction of Roundup Ready herbicide-tolerant crops, of many claims that this technology was reducing pesticide use, but as I tracked official USDA data on the average pounds of herbicides applied, it didn't strike me that was actually being borne out in fact. So I came out with my first report in 2004 assessing the difference in per acre total herbicide applications on corn, soybean, and cotton planted to genetically engineered varieties with the Roundup Ready gene versus corn, soybeans, and cotton varieties that were conventional and hence on which weeds were controlled the good old-fashioned way with conventional herbicides. As my 2012 study showed, for the first few years, about 3 years, there was a modest decline in both herbicide use and insecticide use as a result of the planting of GE crops. But beginning in year four, which would have been the year 2000, the increases really started to pick up and have continue to rise at a faster rate each year over the last now 12 years or so. For example, in 1995, the year before Roundup Ready soybeans were introduced, the average soybean acre in the United States was treated with 1.1 pounds of herbicides. The last time the USDA surveyed soybean pesticide use was 2012, just 2 years ago. And in that year, the average use was 1.72 pounds. So since the introduction of GE crop technology, the average per acre use of herbicides has gone up over 0.6 of a pound and over 60%. And there's simply no serious debate among weed scientists about what has driven this. And it's the spread of resistant weeds and the fact that herbicide-tolerant technology is linked to the application of a glyphosate herbicide, which is applied at a relatively high dose compared to many other herbicides. So,
yeah, but isn't glyphosate? No, yeah, to Tom has a question too. Tom, go ahead.
Chuck,
I've just tried to share with people what the official USDA data says, and let people sort it out.
Right. So, Chuck, a quick question for you. I don't know if you saw Dan Charles's post a few weeks ago.
Taking
issue with me over something that I cited from Food and Water Watch. But what Charles was saying was that since the rise of GE crops, most of the expansion in herbicide use has been from the expansion of corn and soy, basically based on ethanol, as corn plantings have gotten bigger in the Midwest. But you're just saying right there that average per acre on GE crops has risen by 60%. What's going on there?
It's a good question, and Dan got some things right and other things not right. It is true that the total acres planted to corn have gone up by over 10 million acres in the GE era, and it's also true, of course, that many more farmers are relying largely or exclusively on glyphosate and less so on other herbicides. So you would expect the total volume of glyphosate to go up. But the most important measure to focus on, if you want to answer the question, have herbicide-tolerant GE crops reduced the need to apply herbicides measured by pounds of active ingredient per acre, you have to focus on the averages per acre. And when you use that metric, you see this 60% increase in soybeans, which is about what it is in cotton. The increase is less significant in corn, although it's starting to step up now. So Dan is correct that the expansion of corn and soybean acres and the switch to Roundup Ready technology has driven the overall increase in glyphosate use. But what I focused on and what is the legitimate measure to focus on is the average per acre use.
But isn't glyphosate supposedly less toxic to the environment? I mean, there was an article in Forbes by John Entine saying that using glyphosate, even if you use more, it's less persistent in the environment and less toxic to animals. So, I mean, wouldn't that sort of come out as a wash? Like, why is it so bad to, aside from breeding resistance?
Why don't you let Tom weigh in on this?
I'll say two things, and I want Chuck to weigh in as well. But I would say one thing is that, first of all, when Chuck can correct me if I'm wrong, but when most toxicity studies look at and Roundup, they're looking at the active ingredient glyphosate.
Right.
But Roundup is glyphosate plus other additives that help it penetrate the plant wall so that it can act as an herbicide. And these additives may not, I think there's a lot of ambiguity and conflicting evidence, but these additives may not be as benign as someone like John Enten, who's never met a chemical that he
didn't
want to take a bath in, says. The second thing, and I think Chuck will back me up on this completely, is that Well, that the idea that Roundup is less toxic and therefore better is becoming less and less relevant as it loses effectiveness, yeah, and farmers turn towards what everyone acknowledges are harsher chemicals like 2,4-D, dicamba, atrazine. Atrazine has been on the rise in recent years and is still very widely used in corn, despite the rise of Roundup Ready. And atrazine is an awful herbicide.
Why? I was curious why, you know, when I picked up those two articles, the one from Entine and the one from Dan Charles on NPR, neither of those authors mentioned the increased use of products like 2,4-D and atrazine or whatever the other more lethal herbicides that are making such a comeback. Do you, Chuck, in your studies, in your follow-up to that study that you did, have you seen or are you able to quantify like the increased use of herbicides being specifically glyphosate, or do you see a tremendous increase in these other herbicides as well as the glyphosate?
Okay, there's three things on the table. Let me start by making a really important point.
Please.
The problem with rapidly increasing herbicide use has been building since 2001, the year the first glyphosate-resistant weed was documented in a Delaware soybean field.
Uh-huh.
The increase in the last 3 years has dwarfed the increase in the previous decade. And the increase next year may dwarf the increase over the last 4 or 5 years. So this, if you only look at this problem based on the most recent USDA data, which for corn is 2010, cotton is 2010, and soybeans 2012, you miss the dramatic acceleration in additional herbicide use that has been happening in the last 2 or 3 years. And you also miss this sense of urgency, if not panic, in the presentations made by wheat scientists, especially those coming from the Southeast where this problem has been so severe. Mm-hmm. So we really, the reason Dan Charles isn't aware of a lot of this is he probably looked at the latest data available from the USDA and missed all of the information that has come out in the last 2 or 3 years characterizing this dramatic increase in the last 3 years. The second key point is that farmers now that have 2 or 3 glyphosate-resistant weeds in their fields are having to resort to almost any herbicide that still works on those weeds. I mean, they're kind of scraping the bottle of the barrel or the bottom of the toolbox, and we now see official recommendations from university wheat scientists in Tennessee and Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana to spray glyphosate 2 or 3 times, to spray 2 long-term residual grass herbicides like atrazine or metolachlor at least 2 times, to spray 2,4-D at least 1 time, dicamba possibly 1 time, and even paraquat 1 time.
Wow.
Plus 2 other post-herbicides. So if you look at what they're saying, they're up now to at least 5 and as many as 7 active ingredients per acre. And when you add up all the pounds, they're up in the 4 to 6 pound range for total applications. And this is the reality. So things have really changed rapidly. And just returning for a minute to glyphosate and the risk associated with it. In general, the toxicological profile and the environmental profile of glyphosate is very good relative to other registered herbicides. Tom is right. Some of the adjuvants and surfactants clearly increase the toxicity of glyphosate, and actually Monsanto and the industry has gone away from some of the more toxic ones in their formulations that are being sold today. But the problem with glyphosate is that there's so much of it used now in so many different environments that every American is being exposed to glyphosate multiple times per year, if not on nearly a daily basis. It's starting to show up in all of our urine and all of our blood. It's in the rain everywhere. People are breathing it. And at some point, even with a relatively benign chemical like glyphosate, toxicological concerns are going to arise. And this concern from the exposure side, you know, which is definitely ballooning, is made worse by some of the recent studies that have been published that actually suggest that glyphosate may pose some long-term risks that were not apparent in the original toxicological work done on it. So I think there is a real essential need now for the government, for the industry to take a hard and fresh look at both glyphosate exposure levels and risk, because we are engaged in a gamble that's involving most of the American population,
if not the rest of the developing world, because they're all planting those GMO crops as fast as they can. Chuck, we have to take a short break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Dr. Charles Benbrook and the wonderful Tom Philpott, who hasn't had nearly enough to say yet. So. Stay with us.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
We are back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. In the studio with me is journalist Tom Philpott, who has written extensively about GMO and GM crops. And on the phone is Dr. Charles Benbrook from Washington State University, I believe. And we're talking GM tech. So, Chuck, one of the things that Tom and I both thought were interesting about what you've been doing lately, and which also was referenced in the recent USDA government report on genetically engineered crops, is the price of seeds, of soybean and corn seeds. And just according to this, to the USDA report, the price has grown by 50% in real terms between 2001 and 2010, and GE cotton even faster, et cetera, et cetera. So what does all this mean? Planting BT corn continues to be more profitable as measured by net returns than planting conventional seeds, but I mean, ultimately, if you're spending a lot of money on buying more herbicides, et cetera, I'm not sure where your numbers are going there. Can you talk a little? I know you've been doing a little work on this, so can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I found it very curious that the ERS used seed costs in 2001 as the baseline in comparing the cost of GE seeds to conventional, because if they'd gone back to 1996, which was really the beginning, you would see that soybean seed has risen by close to doubled. Corn seed has probably gone up 3 to 4-fold, and cotton seed has gone up 6-fold or more. The increases in seed prices have been substantial, and there's another factor that most people don't realize, and that is since 1996, over the last 16 years, the rate of seeding per acre has gone up about 50% in all of these crops. So, in other words, not only has the price of seed gone up, but farmers are planting far more seeds per acre, so they're overall expenditures on seeds have gone up very dramatically. I would say that sometime in the last 3 or 4 years for all of the GE, primary GE crops, the economic proposition became a negative one in that they're making less per acre in terms of net returns. But what they're getting is the much simpler weed management and insect management system. So there is a clear trade-off there, but there I don't think that there's much question now that that GE technology is not saving money compared to conventional varieties. There's many studies that contradict that now.
So in other words, the yield for these crops is not commensurate with the price of the seeds, if you see what I mean. Like, they're not getting that much higher a yield.
Yeah,
they're paying that much more.
As Tom has written, none of the GE technologies were designed to increase the inherent yield potential of the crops. They're all about trying to make it easier for farmers to deal with either Lepidopteran insects or weeds.
Right. Tom, you were going to say
something. One thing that that I would just add is that that in the I think this year, 2014, we've seen that the price of corn in the marketplace has come down a little bit for various global reasons, and that the cost of production of corn continues climbing upward. Seed prices are higher, rents continue to rise in the Midwest, and we're at the point now where the cost of production, this is kind of remarkable, the cost of production of corn has gone above the market price of corn, and that's the first time this has happened since the rise of government-controlled ethanol mandate starting in 2006 that really kind of pushed corn through the roof. And so now we are seeing this happen. And of course, when that happens, the government makes up the difference, and we have all kinds of programs in place to do that. And that's great for the seed companies and the input suppliers, because they will continue selling their products even when farmers are losing money per acre. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen as the growing season goes on. Maybe there's going to be a drought in the Midwest or a drought in some other growing region, and the price of corn spikes again. But it's looking like 2014 is going to be a losing season for farmers.
Amazing. And that has an impact on the livestock markets all the way across the board, since so many of the livestock sectors rely on corn as a feed.
Well, they're happy to have the cheaper corn. They've been punished by high corn in recent years.
They have been, but they people will plant less corn. I mean, you know, because it'll end up being where they trade off. They'll start shrinking supplies. Our corn reserves were very low. We've had drought. So a lot of crops failed last year, the year before that. So there's a shrinking supply of beef cattle because of that, and there's a shrinking supply of corn worldwide, I think, for the same reasons. Guys, let's talk for a second because we have as much time as we want, actually. I've just made that decision. Oh, no. Sari is saying no, no, no. I wanted to talk a little bit about crops that are not commodity crops, staples like corn, soy, and cotton. I wanted to talk about some reasons why foods have not. The only ones I know of are the papaya, right, and the gold rice, which is supposed to have this like phenomenal yield, plus have beta carotene in it.
Right.
Are there any other food crops that are being developed as genetically modified organisms? And if not, why not? Is it for the same reasons as? Are there reasons why? I mean, is it because they're not so successful in the commodities?
The only important new GE crop for the average consumer is sweet corn.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Last year, Monsanto introduced a new sweet corn technology that expresses two different BT genes and also is herbicide-tolerant Roundup Ready. Those sweet corn varieties have already captured over a third of the market in Canada, although adoption in the U.S. last season was much lower, probably less than 10%. It remains to be seen how widely it will be planted in 2014, the Monsanto varieties. Apparently, they don't do that well out here in the West, where a lot of the fresh sweet corn and processing sweet corn is grown. But this is the first fruit and vegetable that's consumed in a largely unprocessed form by people that will deliver a quite significant dose of these BT proteins to people. And I've been really deeply concerned about the allergenic potential of this technology and arguing for the industry to voluntarily label any sweet corn containing the engineered proteins in order to give people and their doctors a chance to recognize whether they are in fact having an allergic reaction.
Right.
The other big technologies that are coming down the line that may or may not get approved are there's a genetically engineered potato that expresses a lower level of a known carcinogen called acrylamide. That technology is developed has been developed by Simplot and is in the government review process. And there are certainly several others, but the fundamental reason why we don't have GE grapes or apples or carrots or lettuce or tomatoes on the market is that those foods are consumed in substantial volumes by people, often in a fresh or near-fresh form, and that means that people would be exposed to the proteins, and that also means that the companies would have to do long-term safety studies in experimental animals, and they have shied away from doing that up to this point, but I can't imagine, or I certainly hope that the FDA wouldn't allow any of these major fresh fruits and vegetables to come on the market with transgenic proteins in them without long-term safety testing.
You think? See, I have no such I have no such faith in the FDA, Chuck. I'm surprised to even hear you say that. I mean, they seem willing to let us. I mean, I'd love to have a little chat about GRAS, G-R-A-S, generally regarded as safe, because that's a designation that gets thrown around all the time, whether it's nanotech, whether it's genetically modified organisms. I mean, it's like whatever it is, they don't feel like testing it. The FDA just gives them a GRAS rating, and it's all good.
But just let me, one quick point. It's not just up to the FDA. If you ask the apple industry in Washington State, the largest apple industry in the country, if they want to grow the genetically engineered Arctic apple, the resounding answer is no, because they know that the minute Washington apple growers start planting that genetically engineered variety, they're going to lose most of their Pacific Rim markets, regardless of what the FDA does. So the reason that GE technology is not moving into other grains, it's not moving into fruits and vegetables, is because the American food industry understands that it will lose, maybe a third of its export market for any of these commodities the day they plant genetically engineered varieties.
That is true, although everybody seems to have been buying our corn without a whimper, or our soy, right? I mean,
but people don't eat our corn and soy. It's fed to animals or converted to oils.
I guess that's right. Yeah,
ethanol.
That makes sense. Well, I guess we have to wrap it up here, guys. Do you want to promote speaking engagements, writings, blogs, whatever you want?
Let me just step in and say that for people listening in the New York area, I'm doing an event tonight at Marcus Samuelson's place in Harlem.
Red Rooster.
Downstairs from Red Rooster is Ginny's Supper Club at 6:30 tonight. We have a panel discussing diversity in the restaurant kitchen. We've got Marcus Samuelson. We've got Gabriel Hamilton from Prune. We've got Floyd Cordoz, who he's a fantastic chef. He was a
Tabla.
He was a founding chef of Tabla and is now running a restaurant down in Lower Manhattan. It's going to be a great discussion. It starts at 6:30. There is drinks and food from Red Rooster when we start. We'll have cocktails for a while and then we'll move to the panel discussion. So come on out.
You can get tickets on Eventbrite.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So thanks, you guys. Thanks, Chuck. Thank you very much for joining us today. It was really interesting, very informative and helpful. I hope the whole GM question has been somewhat elucidated in these two discussions. I could see there's a lot more to go, though. And Tom, thanks so much for joining me in the studio today. It's a real pleasure.
It's fantastic to be here at this incredible restaurant. The smells coming into the studio are amazing.
And we get to watch somebody eating pizza right in front of us. All right. Thanks to my sponsor, Cane Five Winery. Yeah, Chuck? Cheers. Bye-bye. That's all, folks. We'll see you next week. Sorry about that.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.